Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement by former President Jimmy Carter that he has melanoma cancer that has spread to his brain and today, at the age of 90, is undergoing the first of four radiation treatments. Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and author of Jimmy Carter, joins us to discuss his article at CNN, Jimmy Carter's Courage in the Face of Cancer, and America's 39th president's post-presidency since 1981 that has been remarkably active, making Jimmy Carter still a very influential figure in foreign relations and public life. Then we will speak with Max Hoffman, a political analyst on the National Security and International Policy team at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions. We will discuss the recent agreement to allow NATO to use a Turkish airbase in exchange for giving Turkey's President Erdogan a green light to bomb the Kurdish PKK as well as the Islamic State. We'll assess whether Erdogan's cynical power play to start wars to win elections will backfire as blowback from both the Islamic State and the PKK, who are conducting terrorist acts inside Turkey, escalates with the Turkish military suffering growing casualties. Then finally, we will look into the resignation of Greece's Prime Minister Alex Tsipras, who has called for new elections in September, and speak with James Angelos, a freelance journalist and former correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, who also wrote for The New York Times. He is the author of the new book, The Full Catastrophe, Travels Amongst the New Greek Ruins, and we will discuss how Tsipras might handle the rebellion by 43 of 149 of his Syriza Party MPs who oppose the bailout that Greece just got from Eurozone countries to avoid a default today on payments owed to the European Central Bank. And joining us now is Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a Ford Academic Fellow at the New American Foundation. His books include Jimmy Carter and The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society. He's a regular contributor to CNN, and his latest article at CNN is Jimmy Carter's Courage in the Face of Cancer. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
And Jimmy Carter made this press conference where he told the world that he has four spots on his brain, that melanoma that was discovered in his liver had spread to his brain, and that today, Thursday, he will undergo the first of four radiation treatments. And he's a man of 90 years old, incredibly active and amazingly jocular and jovial in this press conference, didn't you think?
He was. I mean, that fit his character throughout his whole life, meaning he always tends to be both optimistic and comfortable with whatever situation he faces, and has been able to see a long-term path ahead with what he has. And so it was really remarkable, and I think many people were impressed with how they saw him handling this very difficult situation. I think he even describes the next phase with the treatment as a new adventure in their life, which is not how most people would characterize it.
But he, as you've written in your article at CNN, Julian Zelizer, Jimmy Carter's Courage in the Face of Cancer, he has sort of raised the bar and set the standard for post-presidencies. I mean, obviously, he didn't have the most successful presidency, and he only did one term. But nobody can argue that he hasn't been incredibly active and amazingly successful as a post-president.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the sense of content that he has, even facing this difficult circumstances, that he is personally very happy and pleased and proud with what he's done since 1981. He remade what it meant to be a post-president. He used the Carter Center in Atlanta as a base of operations to pursue diplomatic initiatives that interested him, to publish books about all sorts of issues from the Middle East to domestic politics, and to also become involved with elections in places like Central America. And here at home, he was, of course, leading the Habitats for Humanity. So he's had a really rich post-presidential life, and he's also set a framework for presidents to follow him. And I think he feels content and proud of that. So I think that's part of the comfort you see when he talks about dealing with this disease.
Well, he not just, though, in terms of post-presidency, in terms of, for example, the work that you just mentioned, particularly with Habitat for Humanity, that created all of this humanitarian volunteerism, building houses across the country. He also had an impact, or has had an impact, on foreign policy, sometimes annoying the incumbent. Even a fellow Democrat, Bill Clinton, was not too happy that Jimmy Carter personally intervened in North Korea, but arguably, at that time, when there was a possibility of a nuclear war, at least a war in Korea, you can't really argue that Jimmy Carter didn't de-escalate the situation.
No, I think that's true. And there were tensions over how it happened. Initially, Clinton sought his help, but gradually, you know, Carter went much further than the White House was comfortable with, even holds a press conference talking about a deal that the president had not yet been speaking about. And there was a lot of frustration. But many people would argue that he did play an important role, even if the agreement didn't work out over the long run, as some hoped, at diffusing a very tense situation, which is really the mission that Carter has had when dealing with problems overseas. And then he was much more critical of President George W. Bush and an open critic of most of his foreign policy. So many presidents have had a lot of tension with him because he's been so willing to speak his mind and to pursue those policies he thinks are correct.
But just to stay on the North Korean story, Jimmy Carter basically, to some extent, forced Bill Clinton's hand into making a deal. And the deal essentially was that the U.S. would offset any nuclear program that the North Koreans had, which they suspended or froze. And then, to some extent, we reneged. We never supplied the oil that we had promised them. And then when George W. Bush came in, he killed the deal altogether. And guess what happened? The North Koreans quickly moved to nuclear weapons, which they have now attained. So the record on that, Jimmy Carter comes out pretty well, I'd say.
Well, I think there are many people who would agree with you. I think Carter himself was just frustrated that for whoever's responsibility was to blame, that the agreement didn't work out. I mean, central to his agenda, really since his time in the White House, was that these kinds of accords could work. If all the parties adhered to them, they were a better path than military intervention. He's made this argument consistently long before President Obama, and I think the accords, such as what happened in North Korea and other efforts, have been really at the heart of his mission.
And again, I'm speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a Ford Academic Fellow at the New America Foundation. His books include Jimmy Carter and The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society. He's a regular contributor to CNN, where his latest article at CNN is Jimmy Carter's Courage in the Face of Cancer. So in this press conference where Jimmy Carter announced that the melanoma that had been discovered in his liver had spread to four spots on his brain and that would undergo the first of four radiation treatments beginning today on Thursday. And that's pretty debilitating, not to mention that Jimmy Carter is 90 years old. But he was very cheerful, as we said earlier, and basically said, now it's in the hands of God, and I'll be prepared for anything that comes. But he was asked about whether there were any regrets about his life, and obviously he's still with us, so that was somewhat premature, I think, of the reporters. But he did refer to the Iranian hostage crisis and say that, I wish I had sent one more helicopter to get the hostages, and we would have rescued them, and I would have been reelected. What do you think of that?
Well, it's actually something he's been saying for a long time, including right after Reagan's inauguration, when he's being flown away from Washington, and he tells one of his advisors that had the Iranian hostages been released just, you know, a few months earlier, they wouldn't be flying home. And I do think he feels that the way that unfolded from the failed military effort to rescue the hostages to ultimately the Iranians holding the hostages until Reagan became president really did bring down his administration. Is that true? There's other factors at work. The economy was in terrible shape. He had personally had terrible approval ratings. So there were many challenges he faced by the time he ran for re-election. But I do think the regret of his inability to solve that sooner, even though he does solve it in the end, and we forget that, is one of his great sources of frustration. The comment also shows he's more political than we think. We think of Carter as this apolitical person who doesn't care about elections and Congress and politics, but he does think about that. And I thought it was very revealing that that's the first thing he said, not just that the rescue mission would work, but that he would have been reelected.
So do you think that Jimmy Carter, I know that some of the people that work for him, particularly on the National Security Council, like Gary Sick, expert on Iran, at the time of the hostage crisis, he actually wrote a book about the October surprise, basically positing that there was some kind of deal that went that the Reagan administration made with the Ayatollahs to hold the hostages until the end and thus defeat Jimmy Carter's re-election. Do you think Carter himself and the work that, and research that you've done, did he believe that or entertain those ideas, or was he at least troubled by that persistent rumor?
He was troubled by that persistent rumor. I don't think he, in the end, fully believed that was at hand. I think part of what he felt was that many Iranians really disliked him for what he had done with the Shah. And even if this was resolved, there was no way they were going to let Jimmy Carter get credit. And I think he was savvy enough to understand that was at work as much as any kind of deal that Reagan might have orchestrated. But the October surprise, as it remains in political lexicon, was something in the administration that they were thinking about.
But the fact that he did allow the Shah in for cancer treatment, and my understanding is, at least my recollection, is that it was Henry Kissinger who persuaded him to do this. Did he regret that decision?
Well, he has. He was aware at the time exactly how controversial that would be. And even as it's happening, he isn't fully comfortable, with the decision, and he's aware of the kinds of costs that might happen, although he never anticipated the hostage crisis. But I do think he's written about it, as most presidents do. They tend to defend their choices. But I think he's aware that that might have been, one of those key turning points where he made a bad decision.
So in terms of his domestic legacies, what comes to mind with you?
Well, most important is simply putting an important issue on the table with some legislative success, and that was the problem of energy and the need to do a better job conserving resources here in the United States. That was front and center of everything he did in the late 1970s. And even though he didn't obtain everything he wanted from Congress, I think he's the president that really did more than anyone else to say we need to deal with this crisis and this dependency. And so I think that's the biggest issue that he was responsible for. Second, which we don't often remember, was he was very committed to ethics in government, and he was a post-Watergate president. That's how he won election in 76, telling voters they could trust him. And he signs legislation that for many decades created an independent prosecutor to investigate executive branch corruption and created new ethics rules to hold public officials to higher standards. And it didn't all work out the way he hoped, but I think that was really important. And the independent prosecutor no longer exists, but I do think some of the ethics issues he insisted had to remain part of our policy was a big contribution.
But in terms of his warnings about energy dependence and the prolific use of energy, which we are all guilty of here in the United States, we consume more energy per person than any other country on the earth, I think perhaps with the exception of Australia. One of the things I recall from that period, Julian Zelizer, was that he was kind of derided. To some extent, also, the same thing happened with Governor Brown here in California, who tried to run for president a few times. whenever these politicians like Jimmy Carter and Jerry Brown ever sort of try to level with the American people about problems we have and challenges ahead, it doesn't work. All of this happy talk, all that stuff that Reagan got elected on, you know, sunshine in America again, all of that stuff seems to work. And if you look at what's happening now with these presidential runs, particularly listening to the entire field on the Republican side, it's all sort of vacuous happy talk.
Well, I think, you know, in terms of policy, I think there's been a bit more progress than that. And we have tougher environmental standards that have been put into place since the 70s. We've done a better job dealing, at least starting to deal with climate change. We're far away from where we have to be. But you can argue that some of the energy he devoted to this, so to speak, was worth it and set us on the right path. But I do think you're right. He makes a famous speech in 1979 where many people felt he essentially blamed Americans for the problems they faced because he said we consume too much, we don't, you know, focus on the right issues and the right moral issues that we should be dealing with. And people didn't like that at all. Gerald Ford, who came before him, did the same thing. He said the State of the Union's not good. He made a very blunt speech about the economy, and people didn't like that. I think you're right that in general, at least in campaigns, people like the more positive and often very thin arguments that a lot of politicians tend to make.
So at the time, people were saying that he was sort of copying FDR's fireside chats. And I think to some extent he was, at least in terms of the staging. But so what does that say about America? Does it mean that we have to have a Great Depression or a World War II in order to have frank conversations?
Well, there is some truth to that. You know, that was a time of crisis in the late 1970s. The economy was in just horrible shape. So that seems to be the impetus for presidents to actually start dealing with some issues. We can do it outside of crises. Look, in the mid-1960s, the economy was doing great, and the government actually dealt with some structural problems that we faced, like lack of health care insurance for the elderly or federal education. That was the period when Lyndon Johnson was president. So we can have frank conversations in good economic times. But generally, I think you're right. We prefer light politics, and we don't want politicians and candidates to say that much other than things that make us happy. And it's not a great part of our political process.
Well, Julian Zelizer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a Ford Academic Fellow at the New America Foundation. His books include Jimmy Carter and The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. He's a regular contributor to CNN, where his latest article at CNN is Jimmy Carter's Courage in the Face of Cancer. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into Turkey's President Erdogan's cynical power play. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Max Hoffman, who's a policy analyst on the National Security and International Policy team at the Center for American Progress. Focusing on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, U.S. defense budgeting and policy, and the intersections of climate change, human migration, and security concerns, he has organized and undertaken repeated research trips to Turkey, Iraq, Lebanon, Germany, and India. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Hoffman.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
And headlines are coming out today talking about Turkey in crisis. We know that Erdogan, the leader, had sort of more or less tried to have a executive coup over the parliament. That was rejected. He didn't get the number of seats that he'd hoped for, in fact, in part because the Kurds showed up to vote. But then he sort of made this somewhat cynical deal after some hideous bombings by the Islamic State, that he both went after the Islamic State and the Kurds, the PKK. And it looks as though he's getting blowback from both fronts. Is that what's happening?
That's a good overview of what's happening. You know, there are two parallel trends that are coming together in a particularly nasty way in Turkey right now. The first is President Erdogan's ongoing quest to maintain power and, you know, secure his grip on power within Turkey. That was challenged in June with the parliamentary elections in which he was dealt a severe blow. His party, the AKP, lost their outright majority for the first time in over 10 years. And a big part of that, as you mentioned, was that Kurdish voters turned out and voted for the HDP, which is a progressive, primarily Kurdish party. That result was a serious threat to Erdogan's political survival, and he began maneuvering to basically have a rerun, to take the country back to early elections. His chosen successor in the prime ministry, Ahmet Davutoglu, was unable to form a coalition, largely because Erdogan imposed very strict restrictions on what he could offer other parties. And so Turkey has been in these coalition talks for some time, and now Erdogan has the opportunity to take the country back to early elections. The other trend that of course, is now spilling over into Turkey is the civil war in Syria. ISIS trying to get back at the Kurdish militias who had dealt them severe blows in northern Syria, launched a bombing which killed 33 Turkish citizens in Suruç a month ago. President Erdogan has reacted. He's cracked down on ISIS, but he's also used it as cover to crack down on the Kurds, primarily the PKK, which is the militant wing of a wider Kurdish political movement. And so Turkey now is seeing the repercussions of President Erdogan's moves. The PKK is launching regular attacks throughout the southeast, and politics have become very unstable heading towards what will likely be early elections in the next couple of months.
So, continuing with my cynicism, if I may, you know, often the best way to get elected is to have a good war. But in this case, has he miscalculated, if indeed that was his motive?
Ian, you're absolutely right. That certainly appears to be his motive from the outside. It seems that he very cynically calculated that if he reopened the struggle with the Kurds and created something of a siege mentality, he would be able to rally nationalist Turkish support to his side and perhaps win back his absolute majority. Of course, it remains to be seen whether this strategy will work. Erdogan is a very skilled political animal who has survived and ruled and dominated Turkey for over a decade now. But the latest polls show that the AKP is essentially unmoved from where it was in the June elections. If anything, it seems to have ticked down slightly. And as importantly, the support for the Kurdish party, the HDP, seems to be at 13% or perhaps a little higher, just about where it was in the June elections. So it's a big gamble. He's taking his party into another election, the latest in a long run of elections in Turkey. And the tensions are incredibly high, including, you know, periodic attacks by the PKK, and now one fears ISIS as well. And he might get the same or even a worse result at the polls, in which case his personal authority over the country and over his own party, the AKP, could be seriously shaken. So it's a big gamble, and it might not pay off. It remains to be seen.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Hoffman, who is a policy analyst on the National Security and International Policy team at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, U.S. defense budgeting and policy, and the intersections of climate change, human migration, and security concerns. So in terms of what appears to be blowback here, you've got 8 Turkish soldiers killed with a bomb attack in the southeastern province of Syria. And there have been a number of attacks across the border by the Islamic State. clearly prior to that, there had to be either some tacit understanding or at least the turning of a blind eye, because they clearly had a well-developed underground railroad of recruits coming from the diaspora into the Islamic State all the way through Turkey. So was it U.S. pressure that changed him? Was it that bombing that changed his mind? Because, you know, prior to that, he was pretty intractable on letting the U.S. use that NATO airbase at Incirlik.
You're right. He was, and essentially Ankara was bargaining very, very hard with the United States over the use of Incirlik Air Force Base. I think it was a combination of factors that led to this change. In terms of Turkey sort of turning a blind eye to ISIS, there have been widespread accusations and never really any solid proof you could take to the bank. But many people, particularly Kurds, were convinced that Ankara was, if not supporting, at least tolerating ISIS. It's hard to say. It certainly was U.S. pressure that was gradually forcing Turkey to do more and more on that front. But it's a long border. It's difficult to patrol. And I don't think there was ever definitive proof that they were doing such. Their goal, though, Ankara's primary goal was to overthrow Syrian President Assad. And so in the pursuit of that goal, they supported some groups, including Jabhat al-Nusra and other radical Islamist groups that bordered on ISIS and probably shared supplies and fighters in certain cases. So that we can say with some confidence. In terms of the change in policy, pressure from the U.S. and the international community was a big part of it. Also, the Suruç bombing was just such a... this was 33 Turkish citizens killed. They were Kurds, but it was still a situation where the government had to respond. And so this shift was provoked largely by that. It also meant, you know, it provided... Erdogan was very clever in how he used it for his own political gain. However, he knew the U.S. had wanted the use of Incirlik and wanted Turkey to do more against ISIS for a long time. So he gave the U.S. that. And at the same time, he lashed out against the Kurds and the PKK, with whom they had maintained a ceasefire for several years. He lashed out there, and again, I think that most observers agree his goal was to rally nationalist support and create a siege mentality, which he hopes will let him hang on to power. But it was very cynical, and unfortunately, people are dying every day, including Turkish soldiers. It's a great tragedy, and everyone hopes they can return to the ceasefire.
But I can't see how anybody, particularly in NATO and the U.S., on the one hand, you know, they've got the use of this airbase, which is, about 60 miles from the border with Syria. But on the other hand, the only people that have been fighting the Islamic State, both in Iraq and in Syria, have been the Kurds. And the idea that, you know, the U.S. is relying on them, they effectively have become the air force for the Kurds. They can't be too happy with the idea that the Turks are beating up on the Kurds, the only people that are fighting the Islamic State.
No, I don't think U.S. officials are happy at all, but Erdogan put them in a difficult situation. He, you know, by hitting the PKK, which is an affiliate of the Syrian Kurdish groups fighting ISIS in Syria, but not necessarily the same organization, He basically got at this legal distinction. The PKK is listed as a terrorist organization, even though the organization has shifted a great deal in its aims and its tactics over the last, certainly last 3 years. But Erdogan struck them, and the U.S. Couldn't very well take the side of a listed terrorist organization against the Turkish government, even if they were deeply unhappy about the Turkish move. So Erdogan was very clever there. But you're right, the Syrian Kurdish affiliate, the YPG and the PYD, which is the political party overseeing it, have been the only effective ground proxy in Syria in, you know, close coordination with the ally, with the coalition air campaign. They've driven ISIS out of a huge chunk of northern Syria. So this move has made those fighters very angry. It's probably somewhat impacted their ability to carry on their campaign against ISIS, so it's not a welcome move. On the other hand, the U.S. officials thought they were negotiating separately about Incirlik Air Force Base. They, of course, did not anticipate Erdogan would make such a rash and cynical move. So they were initially celebrating the deal because it would allow U.S. fighters and bombers to reach their targets in northern Syria much quicker and therefore spend longer over those targets and make the air campaign more effective. But I think the real question now is, you know, at what cost has that deal come, And at the moment, it looks like it's a bad deal for the U.S., a bad deal certainly for the Kurds, and I think in the long run, a bad deal for Turkey, because Ankara may not realize it, but I think the Kurds are better neighbors than ISIS along that border. So they may live to regret that.
Well, in terms of the Kurdish state in the north of Iraq, which is in many ways a de facto state, and there's a certain puzzlement that I have is why it is that we keep insisting that Iraq is still a country when it's clearly spun off into three. You know, Iran seems to dominate the Shia South, or Shiistan, if you want to call it. Then you've got Jihadistan, the roiling Sunni tribal lands controlled largely by the Islamic State. And then you've got the Kurdistan, or the Kurdish north of Iraq, that is a very prosperous place. Now, my understanding is that it's sort of run by these two sort of rival mafia families, the Talibanis and the Barzanis. But at least they brought some stability and prosperity, and they seem to have brought an awful lot of Turkish investment. So all of that seems to be working out. And the PKK there in the mountains being bombed by the Turks, and the PKK consider Barzani a sellout, don't they? So walk us through that complication.
Well, Ian, you've painted a very good picture of the overall scene. There are divisions within the sort of pan-Kurdish political body. As you mentioned, that within Kurdistan, the KRG, the Kurdistan Regional Government in northern Iraq, there are two parties, the Barzani-affiliated and the Talibani-affiliated parties, and they have reached something of a détente, but, you know, they fought civil wars previously. They don't see eye to eye on a lot of things, and they're political rivals. Barzani, particularly, who is the dominant figure in the KRG, is in a deep rivalry with the PKK and with the PKK's leader, Öcalan, Abdullah Öcalan, for sort of leadership of the wider pan-Kurdish national movement, if you will. So but he's caught in a difficult place. The PKK has gained great popularity because they've been very effective against ISIS. So many Kurds respect them and respect that, you know, their struggle. And yet, they're his political rivals. So he can't very well condemn them. He can't side with Turkey against the PKK because your rank-and-file Kurd on the street would not like that, and he'd be placed under political pressure. But he has deep energy ties, as you said, and investment ties with Turkey. Turkish, you know, the KRG sells all of its energy to Turkey. Turkish truckers and construction firms are really the lifeblood of the KRG economy. So he can't risk a break with Erdogan by siding with the PKK either. So you have the Kurds in northern Iraq sort of caught between these two competing impulses. You know, as to the overall cohesion of Iraq, I think you're certainly right. Many people would share your view that it's not much of a country these days. As to U.S. policy, the question has always been whether the U.S. should have a policy which actually advocates for the separation of Iraq. And most U.S. leaders have concluded that no, that would risk further fighting over disputed territories and oil rights, and better to at least try and make the parties work together, even if I don't think many people harbor much hope of that happening in the near future. So it's a deeply complicated picture, and you know, unfortunately, these Turkish moves have just complicated it further. It was very unexpected, you know, by the way, these Kurdish raids, for example. They didn't deconflict the airstrikes with coalition aircraft operating in northern Iraq. The U.S. only had 10 minutes warning, apparently, and they actually hit PKK targets not far from where U.S. Special Forces were training Kurdish Peshmerga to go and fight ISIS. So it was very unexpected, and it's just sort of further stirred the pot in an already complicated and violent region.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Hoffman, who is a policy analyst on the National Security and International Policy team at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, U.S. defense budgeting and policy, and the intersections of climate change, human migration, and security concerns. But how does Öcalan remain a respected figure and a rival, if you will, to Barzani, as you just told us, when he's been in Turkish custody now for, 10 years?
Yeah, for over a decade. It's a great question, and it's fascinating. Öcalan, he cultivated in the PKK in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, he cultivated a real cult of personality, and there's huge lingering respect as a result. He was also arrested at and thrown in Turkish prison with the help of the United States, I might add, at a kind of almost an opportune time. The PKK was really probably on its last legs, and so he was not forced to capitulate in any way, and I think that's helped his mystique somewhat. You know, in recent years, he's become something of a voice of moderation. He's called for an end to the armed struggle and for, you know, peaceful, for negotiations towards lasting peace with the Turkish government, which I think is what everybody, and, you know, certainly Kurd living in southeastern Turkey would like to see. But he has huge influence. I suspect that the thing Turkey might do that would undermine that influence most would be just to let him out of prison, because then he'd have to deal with the really nitty-gritty day-to-day politics of the Kurdish regions and of Turkey, and it would be a real challenge for him. What's interesting is that within the Kurdish movement in Turkey, there's a new force, a powerful force, in the form of the HDP, which is the legal party led by Selahattin Demirtas, who's a very young, charismatic Kurdish leader. They have sought to broaden their appeal and reach out to ethnic Turks, particularly liberal Turks, and they've included a hugely diverse array of candidates on their party list. And they won big in these, you know, they won 13% of the vote in the June elections and are still polling strong. They could offer a really, you know, interesting, progressive, and peaceful alternative to what has traditionally been a militarized struggle for Kurdish, you know, autonomy, or at least greater Kurdish rights within Turkey. So these intra-Kurdish dynamics are going to be really fascinating to watch play out over the next year or so. And it remains to be seen how much influence, you know, Abdullah Öcalan really has from prison over the day-to-day operations of the PKK, but certainly he's held in very high esteem.
Just in closing, the AKP, the Islamist Development Party, led by Erdogan, and he's had a terrific run, and Turkey has definitely prospered under his leadership. But he's also clearly got out of control ego with that $100+ million palace that he built for himself, and we know about the Gezi Park demonstrations, et cetera, and the callous treatment of miners who killed in accidents, et cetera. I'm just astounded that he's still popular, and you know, you can play the nationalist card, you know, only as long as you're succeeding. You know, look at, you know, George W. Bush was really popular before the Iraq War, but a few years down the line, it doesn't work for you anymore, you know?
President Erdogan has been the defining personality in Turkish politics for a long time. As you say, his AKP has won, you know, repeatedly won these elections, and he's very charismatic. He's often described as Islamist, and that's certainly a strain of his political rhetoric and his, you know, his government also, of course. But what he's also done is very skillfully played on, deep-seated grievances among Turkey's underclass and new middle class, who are generally more devout and really resented the domination of the dominance of the old Turkish elite, sort of the legacy of Ataturk, the republic's founder. These elites in the cities like Istanbul and Ankara had dominated the country since its founding, and Erdogan represented this new current of, you know, more from the provinces, more Islamist and more working class. And he skillfully plays on those class resentments, along with the rhetoric of religion and Islam. So he's still very popular among about, you know, 35% to 40% of the country, and as you said, he's brought tremendous economic growth. But the Turkish economy has slowed down markedly in the last 2 years. It seems to be, you know, on a pretty bad trajectory right now. There's a lot of debt and a lot of foreign direct investment that is fleeing the country given the instability. So I think the economy will be the economy and the level of violence within the country will be the really defining characteristics. And if Erdogan can't address those, and you know, he's only worsened those problems, frankly, he may be on his way out. He may lose further ground in this next election, at which point other leaders within the AKP, within his party, are going to start wondering if he's more of a liability than he is an election, you know, an election bonus. So we will see. A lot depends on the economy, and a lot depends on, you know, if there are daily bombings or shootings in the streets in Turkey. Nobody wants to see an economic crisis, and everybody would like to see peace, but Erdogan is certainly not helping on either of those fronts.
Well, Max Hoffman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me in. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Max Hoffman, who's a policy analyst on the National Security and International Policy team at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, U.S. defense budgeting and policy, and the intersection of climate change, human migration, and security concerns. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the rebellion facing Greece's prime minister from his own party. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Angelis, who's a freelance journalist and former correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, who also wrote for The New York Times. His latest book just out is The Full Catastrophe, Travels Among the New Greek Ruins. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Angelis.
Thanks for having me.
And Prime Minister Alex Tsipras, the Greek Prime Minister, has just announced he's resigning and calling for early elections in September. And my understanding is that his real challenge is to handle the restive left-wing rebels in his party who are not happy about the deals that he's made with the Troika. I don't know the extent to which they consider him a sellout, but it's a bit odd, isn't it, that somebody that comes from the revolutionary left is already being branded a sellout.
Well, I can tell you that a lot of people saw this coming even before, during my trips to Athens, even before Syriza was elected. Greek leftists who I talked to sort of anticipated this because Syriza is, you know, was a broad coalition of leftist groups that's become sort of increasingly centralized, but still quite restive and factionalized in essence. And so one of those factions called the Left Platform is far more strident, far more left than Tsipras is. And, you know, Tsipras, you know, has made the argument that he, you know, had no choice and he's not willing to drive the country to a catastrophic euro exit. And the Left Platform seems to believe that actually euro exit would end up being better for the country.
But the country doesn't believe that, right? Most of the country.
Exactly. And that's why Tsipras has retained his popularity, because, you know, the vast majority of Greeks want to remain in the euro despite the hardships they endured in order to stay. So what Tsipras seemed to give them what they wanted, which was a fight with the creditors, a fight but they did. Ultimately, they also wanted a compromise too, and that's what they got.
Well, but his coalition, which of course has been dissolved now that he's called new elections, was with the Conservative New Democracy Party, wasn't it?
Tsipras.
Yeah.
No.
Well, what was the Conservative Party that he was allied with in this coalition?
Oh, I see. Yeah. The Independent Greeks Party.
Oh, sorry, the Independent Greeks Party.
Right. The New Democracy was the previous. Led the previous coalition government. Immediately following the election, Tsipras went into the coalition government with a sort of right-wing populist party called the Independent Greeks. That basically the one thing that they had in common with that party was and is this anti-bailout stance. That party, the Independent Greeks Party, supported Tsipras in the parliamentary votes to push through the bailout. So that party wasn't the source of the problem for Tsipras. It came from within Syriza.
So, but does it mean that he's going to have to reach out to the Conservative New Democracy? They're the second largest party, aren't they?
They are. I don't You know, it's hard predicting Greek elections. Is probably a fool's game, but what I think will happen, and what I think is very likely to happen, is Tsipras. All of this, the referendum that took place, the big no vote, and the events, the recent events in Greece that led up to eventually the reversal in policy. All those events actually, what they showed was that Tsipras was really the dominant political figure in Greece right now. That there's no real, there's no real challenger for him, and that includes the previous prime minister resigned after the leader of New Democracy resigned after the no vote, because that referendum was taken, and as much as it was a repudiation of the creditors at that time, anyway, it was also a repudiation of the old establishment parties that were advocating a yes vote. So even though the referendum ultimately didn't come to do anything, and Greece totally made a reversal, it did show the extent of the political popularity Tsipras enjoys. And right now, what he's doing is wagering that he's going to get more support, and he's going to come out of this with a new Syriza that is more moderate and more willing to cooperate with him.
And again, I'm speaking with James Angelis, who is a freelance journalist and former correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. His latest book just out is The Full Catastrophe, Travels Among the New Greek Ruins. And of course, Greece just got its $13 billion, $14.4 billion, arrived just in time for Greece to repay $3.2 billion due today on government bonds held by the European Central Bank, and that failure to have paid that would have resulted in a default. So it's a kind of surreal situation, isn't it, James, that they're borrowing money to pay money back to the same people they're borrowing from?
That's what's been going on for a while.
I understand.
That's the nature of these bailouts. They're keeping Greece from defaulting on its debts, but then it's not doing much more than that in terms of, it's not money that the sort of Greek people are enjoying, which is I think a common, you know, sometimes you hear in northern European countries, there's a perception that the money's going into some sort of black hole, in Greece. And actually, it's just going right back out and paying off the old debts. So they're taking on new debts in order to pay off old debts. That said, the new debts come at a very favorable interest rate and longer maturities. So in a way, you're paying off. It still is beneficial for Greece, but it's not money that's going to fund state activities. And Greece had gotten to the point anyway where it was more or less funding itself. It had a primary surplus, although that has probably now gone. But in any case, yes, this is money that's coming in to pay off old debts.
So the real question then would be, is there a plan, a possibility that this cycle can be broken? Is there any way, because the whole point of austerity, or at least the whole consequence of austerity, has been an economic slowdown and a hollowing out of the Greek economy and of the standard of living. And that's always been understood, that is why austerity is so counterintuitive, that what you need to do when you have these kind of economic problems is to stimulate the economy and have growth and a greater prosperity. So since we've seen this bad movie of austerity, when are we going to see some change, do you think, in terms of growth and reversal of the downward trend?
I think Greece has been so, the Greek economy has been so battered over the past 5 years, 6 years, that at this point, political stability, any form of sort of political stability, and also assurance that it will remain in the euro, and which would give investors confidence to start putting money back into the country, that alone would do a lot to help restore economic growth, but it's true that Greece needs a plan, or Greece needs some plan to a growth-oriented plan as opposed to a fiscal discipline plan, which it's had plenty of. There have been some moves towards opening up the possibility for more investment in Greece coming from Europe as part of the connected to the recent agreement. And what's more important probably, and what Tsipras is looking forward to is debt relief of some kind that should they pass this first wave of measures and implement them, and the first review from the creditors of Greece's sort of implementation, if that goes well, Greece is likely to get debt relief in the form of pushing out maturities and then lowering interest rates on its loans. So Greece will be, you know, paying off those loans it's getting in 40 years. So that more or less constitutes a form of debt relief. And if the program stays on track, that's likely to come. And that would mean that the IMF would also become involved in the third bailout, because so far it has not, because it finds the debt level for Greece too unsustainable to participate at this point.
So is Greece getting any relief for the fact that its shores are being swamped by refugees from the Syrian civil war? And these people are arriving in desperate shape. And I've seen news coverage of parks in Greece filled with desperate migrants from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from Syria. And these people are, you know, being fed by Greek volunteers and given water. And Greece is not in great economic shape, but it has to also deal with this burden. Is anybody helping them?
Well, that's a long and complicated and terrible story. I mean, what's happening in Greece right now, what has been happening not just in Greece, but in Italy previously, Greece is sort of the new epicenter, and it has been before. It shows how the European policies with regard to asylum and refugees are just completely broken down, completely dysfunctional. You know, according to the way European regulations are supposed to work in terms of how asylum applications are supposed to work, is that the country that first receives an asylum seeker is responsible for processing that asylum claim, but that does not happen. It does not happen in Greece because conditions in Greece have been considered so bad for years now that no European countries, like Germany, is not going to deport a Syrian refugee back to Greece now. If the regulations worked as they were sort of intended to, that's actually what was supposed to be the case. But the situation in Greece is so bad that that's been suspended. What you have in Greece is a combination of Greece's total unwillingness to try to, this is like going back now for many years, to have an asylum system that would be well functioning, because if they did, that would mean that they would be completely and utterly overburdened. So they sort of pushed that, they sort of done in a way what they've previous governments in particular have done what they could to pass that burden off to other European countries. And that's largely because the system is designed such that it's unworkable. So there's an incentive for these southern European countries to not follow the rules because they're unrealistic anyway.
And again, I'm speaking with James Angelis, who is a freelance journalist and former correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. His latest book just out is The Full Catastrophe: Travels Among the New Greek Ruins. So just returning to the situation in Greece, where the Prime Minister, Alex Tsipras, resigned and called for new elections in September. Just to try and summarize your analysis here, James Angelis, I take it that this is really about adults in the room having to deal with a difficult situation that is not of their making, and that they really have to somehow deal with the ideologues on the far left and the far right. Is that a summary of where things stand?
Yeah, I think so. I think, Greece right now, the Greek government has lost its governing majority. And so it's determined that it's too weak, to proceed, because it can only pass through these bailouts with the support of opposition parties. So Syriza is trying, Tsipras right now is just trying to make sure, to ensure that he consolidates his political support. And there's a very strong chance he will. And what that essentially means is that the left the hard left faction within Syriza that's been opposing, that has not been cooperating, refusing to sign the bailout, to vote for the bailout agreement. They will now form their own party, and that will become the new anti-bailout party, or one of the new anti-bailout parties in Greece.
So, but is this essentially where, you know, the perfect is the enemy of the good, that people, you know, who are more idealistic, at least on the left, the New Dawn Party on the right, I don't think you call them idealistic, but are they just sort of getting an ideological free ride that they don't have to deal with the messy problems that are on Tsipras's plate?
Well, of course. I mean, for years now, there's been a Communist Party of Greece that has been advocating, not to mention Golden Dawn, but the Communist Party of Greece, anyway, has been advocating exit of the Euro, exit out of the European Union, exit out of NATO, exit out of the sort of living in a sort of parallel universe, but it remains there, and it's always gets at, you know, it's always a presence in the parliament. There's very little possibility that it will, I mean, should that party or should other parties have to govern, of course, the reality has become more complicated. But there are extreme parties on the left and right in Greece that can remain extreme without having to deal with governing realities. One sort of bigger picture way to look at this, though, is the recent events in Greece, is that the main anti-bailout party for the past few years has been Syriza. Now that Syriza has gone over towards the bailout camp and signed a memorandum of understanding, just like the previous governments have, you now have really the only the sort of the real extremes of Greek politics left who are railing against the participation in the bailout deals. It's a bit of an irony that Greek politics that now, you know, 5 years later, the bailout has passed through Parliament with more support than it's ever had before.
Well, James Angelos, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with James Angelos, who's a freelance journalist and former correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, who also wrote for the New York Times. His latest book just out is The Full Catastrophe, Travels Among the New Greek Ruins. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by